What happens to contraceptive use if it's made free?
Do men and women respond similarly to the treatment of heart disease?
What happens to the evolution of COVID when somebody has a long-term persistent infection?
And screening younger adults for colorectal cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to toss the ball to you. Let's go to JAMA, this issue of screening young adults for colorectal CA. There's three different things we're taking a look at in JAMA this week relative to this issue.
Since the 1990s, the incidence of colorectal cancer has increased among younger adults. We're talking about adults less than 50 years of age, and it's observed not only in the U.S., but worldwide as well. And so in 2018, the American Cancer Society revised their recommendations to begin screening not at age 50 years of age, but at 45 years of age. That raises three questions. How are we going to reach the 45 million U.S. adults that are now eligible for screening? If we expand eligibility to younger patients, is it going to divert resources and compromise the progress we've made in screening older patients? And then finally, what's the effect on population level outcomes? A study provided four different ways of screening these individuals. One is to recommend the fecal immunotesting. The second is to provide the option of colonoscopy. The third is to provide them the option of either. And the fourth was, you don't even provide them an option. You just mail the fecal immunotesting and ask them to do it and mail it back. When they mailed the FIT testing and asked them to return it, about a fourth of individuals did. The other types of screening, they were about half as effective. Second study was, does this divert resources away from older adults? While the screening for younger adults increased substantially from about 21% in 2019 to as much as 34% in 2023, there was no decrease among screening in older individuals. In fact, it slightly increased. What are the population outcomes? The incidence of cancer in this younger group increased slightly, about 1% annually from 2004 to 2019, and a 12% increase from 2019 to 2022. So these three studies provide insight into what we know about cancer screening in younger individuals.
I think this is really an awareness issue. I think that many, and I'm going to harken back to my own experience of being at that age, the notion that somehow one is at risk to develop a life-limiting, potentially life-threatening cancer seems really remote. And I think that transitioning into that level of awareness is one task that lies before us. And then I would muddy the waters a little further here. I've recently reported on a blood test for screening for colorectal CA. And it's interesting because this study shows that the blood test is not ready for prime time, not even remotely, because these lesions are just way too advanced by the time it detects them. Having said that, I would say that what I thought was intriguing in this study was that there was this yick factor that young people or anybody who's being screened for colorectal CA doesn't want to do the preparation for the colonoscopy because that's pretty icky. And then the notion of sampling one's own stool and putting it onto something and sending it off in the mail, that also has got a yick factor associated with it.
So it's interesting, Elizabeth, because if you tell people, you know, we think you ought to screen and here's the way you do it, only about 15% of them participated. But if you mailed it and said, hey, do this because the increasing rate of cancer in your age group is important, then as many as 30% of people mailed it back. Although there is somewhat of a yick factor. If you take the volitional aspect away and mail it to them, they're much more likely to participate.
It's like the surreptitious. You don't have to ask for it, but if we give it to you, you'll use it.
Yeah, we're going to make it easy. We're going to tell you why and just send it back.
It's not that bad. I think I'm going to look forward to the notion that not in the too distant future, we are going to have a very practical blood test for this.
Oh.
Let's turn from here to The Lancet. Let's talk about this issue of, gosh, if you have a long-term persistent infection with SARS-CoV-2, that fun virus that's been so much in our lives for the last 5+ years, what goes on with that virus as this infection persists? This study I thought was remarkable in that they had to screen folks for those who had persistent viral infections. This study was done in the UK. They have an Office for National Statistics survey. They were looking at folks who had infections with a high viral load and available genomic sequences, at least two of those, from all kinds of SARS-CoV-2 lineages. I won't name them all. They were able to identify 576 persistent infections that had these two sequences. They said, okay, who is it who ended up with a bunch of variants that they were presumably shedding out into the environment? This persistent infection was more common in males than in females and in people older than 60 years of age. They found no associations with age, sex, vaccination status, previous infection, or the viral lineage. They identified 379 recurrent mutations that were with known or predicted negative fitness effects and low prevalence at the population level. They also find that the likelihood that these folks were out there infecting others was extremely low. And that is comforting because now that we know that there's lots of people out there with long-term infections where they're shedding a bunch of viruses, at least we don't have to worry about, gosh, do we need to put you in a quarantine?
Yeah. And so when you talk about persistent viral load, these are people that you could detect a virus for 26 days or longer. Although the longer someone has a high viral titer, the more likely they are to undergo evolutionary or genetic changes. These genetic changes did not render the virus particularly more easily to transmit or to cause more severe disease.
As we've suggested before in our discussions about SARS-CoV-2 or any other viral infection, I would add parenthetically, I would like to see studies that looked at that. How many times does the flu, for example, really mutate within an individual or persist for a really long period of time? We don't know that.
There are people that continue to get tested over a long period of time. Even if you can detect virus for a month or two afterwards, it doesn't contribute to infectivity. I don't really see any particular need to do that.
How often are we incubators for the generation of a lot of viral variants? And as you know, in the flu, for example, we've fingered in the past birds and pigs as being these mixing vessels and generating a lot of variants. I'm just wondering, gosh, where are humans in that equation?
Yeah. It was interesting that none of the different variants of COVID were associated, whether it's Alpha or Delta or any of the BA variants, increase that risk.
Let's move to your next one in the BMJ.
Is there a difference between men and women with respect to how they respond to treatment for heart disease? I'm going to talk about people who have coronary artery disease, a blockage in one or more arteries. And the typical treatment for that is to provide antithrombotic therapy or prevent clotting. We do that by using one of two groups of medications, one called anticoagulants or antiplatelet agents. We've really never, in a very systematic way, looked to see whether men and women respond the same to these medications. They are associated with a major side effect that is bleeding, and is the risk of bleeding in men and women the same? So these investigators looked at 33 different trials that enrolled over 274,000 participants. About a fourth of these were women, and they looked at the relative risk of death with antithrombotic agents and determined that the relative risk of death was comparable for more intensive versus less intensive antithrombotic in both men and women. However, if you looked at the more intensive therapy, there was about a 15% reduction in the risk of myocardial infarction. And again, that was in both men and women. Unfortunately, major bleeding increased by 40%. That was the same for men and women.
I think this is a really good study in that we have discerned lots of sex differences in heart disease in men and women, and we've certainly based a lot of risk calculations and we've criticized these studies because they've been disproportionately based on that condition in men and then extrapolated to women. So I at least am glad to see a study that examines this specifically and comes up with this conclusion.
And more specifically, I think that there was some reticence without this data that the risk of antithrombotic therapy was higher in women and they were less likely to receive a benefit. So oftentimes they didn't receive more intensive therapy or sometimes didn't receive therapy at all compared to their male counterparts. So this data should assure us that yes, women should be considered in the same way that men are with respect to the risk and benefits of antithrombotic therapy.
Finally, then, let us turn or let us remain in the BMJ. And gosh, if you make long-term contraceptives free, what happens to their uptake? This is a study that was conducted in British Columbia, Canada, and that's exactly what they were examining. We're going to make long-acting reversible contraception free. What happens to that number of monthly dispensations? They had almost 850,000 plus female residents of British Columbia. Let's call it a sentinel event, which is they made a policy change and they said now they're free. What they found is that they had a 1.49-fold increase in the number of women who came forward to have these long-acting reversible contraceptives. They also saw that in the 15 months after the policy change, the market share increased in women who were using that type of contraception. This against the background that they cite that 40% of pregnancies worldwide are unintended, with 48% of pregnancies in North America. They figure inadequate contraception access as increasing or accounting for a large part of that number. Is cost a giant barrier? And at least according to the results of this study, it seems like the answer to that is yes.
Two issues. One is accessibility to contraception, and the other one is effectiveness. With regard to effectiveness, when one talks about the long-acting reversible contraception, the IUD, and also these subdermal implants, less than 1% of people who use a LARC, these long-acting reversible contraceptives, will become pregnant each year, compared with about 4 to 7% of people who use oral contraceptive pills and 10 to 13% of condom users. What about availability of contraception just in general? And as you mentioned, making them free increased the number or the percentage of the population in British Columbia that used any type of contraception, and more importantly, used the most effective form of contraception.
I thought it was noteworthy that among different age groups that they examined, this number varied a little bit, with the biggest uptake in those who were aged 20 to 29 years. And that makes sense to me.
Why so?
Because I think that those are the years in which women may become sexually active, but don't necessarily want to have children. Probably haven't married or committed to a relationship yet, and so wanting to make sure that that's not a circumstance they have to deal with is probably more front and center. That would be my guess.
And what the study shows is cost is an important contributor to either contraceptive use and, more importantly, to the use of LARCs because those cost in Canada, they cost about 450 Canadian dollars. In the UK, about 250 to $300. And so cost ends up being a barrier, and especially to the more effective types of contraception. And taking that away increases both use of contraception and the most effective type as well.
Another great public health message. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up. Make healthy choices.